The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
It's a Sunday morning. You are listening to Beat. I hope you're doing well this morning. Let's talk a few things that are happening in the summer, because new work created by local theatre makers is top of the bill at the Theatre Royal in Waterford this summer. It includes stage productions of news plays by Waterford writers Wayne Power and Niamh Fennessy, both who have been here in the Sunday Grill before. So make sure that's there. It is, yeah. Dress You Up is the play written by writer, poet and spoken word artist Wayne Power, and it comes to the Theatre Royal on the 11th of July. It's set in the 90s during full on girl power, and it's a great story that Wayne will tell us about in a few minutes time. But Wayne is also here to talk to us about life for him possibly a decade ago now. Is there even more?
I think the last time we would have spoken, Orna, would have been when I was doing the radio course out here, which was about Six years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
So Wayne did the broadcast course that we have here in podcasting and presenting. And Wayne has a really interesting and very powerful backstory that I think will resonate with some of our listeners this morning. And I think a story that people think is over now, and you're here to say it's not always over.
Not always.
Instagram versus reality in a lot of
cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you were or are agoraphobic? How would you describe that?
I would say, or I was. Okay. Because like what I'm trying to do now is kind of like let go of that. To go forward, if that doesn't sound too cheesy. So like I was diagnosed with agoraphobia when I was I was 21, but I was formally diagnosed when I was about 24.
Okay.
But the diagnosis would have been there when I was 21.
So you got the kind of official diagnosis at 24.
Yeah, because obviously I couldn't leave the house. So I you know, now having said that, my doctor, who is Mark Rowe, who I've never thanked publicly, but I must thank publicly, he did a lot for me. And, you know, so the years from like 2005 to 2008 were, I was like completely housebound.
How would you describe agoraphobia for people who mightn't have heard that before? That
agoraphobia,
term?
It's a fear of open spaces, like in a literal sense, but also for me, it was just a fear of having a panic attack in an open space where you couldn't escape or be in your kind of safe zone.
Okay.
You know, so the safe zone for me was kind of around where I was living, that kind of parameter. So when I did get out of the house, we'd say 2009, the next like 8 years or 9 years rather were kind of spent different therapists and different medications, and just like I would go out every day and you would see me. But I'd get to a certain point and kind of I'd feel that same sort of anxious feeling, and all the alarm bells went off in the head and you're kind of thinking, oh, I'm going to have a panic attack. There was no logic to it, you know.
So it manifested itself for you as you fearing having a panic attack because you're outside, not fearing being outside.
Not so much fearing being outside. Now, having said that, as the years went on, and even like in recovery, you know, there'd be certain, you know, rural settings, you know, would still be kind of like, it'd still feel a little bit like, oh, now I get the open space thing, because like I'm so used to being in the city.
And did that freak you out, that sort of open space?
It did up until recently. Like there's been kind of a lot of breakthroughs and stuff. So like, you know, the initial fear kind of breaks down after you've kind of, You've exposed yourself to certain situations. So where I'm at now, I'm 7 years in recovery from last week.
Wow.
So I was kind of just reflecting, and a good friend of mine said, look, 7 years is a cycle, so it's over, you know. So I do see it as over, but the only problem I have these days is getting out of Waterford is still a bit of a challenge.
Okay.
Now, having said that, I'm getting there slowly, and I'm trying to drop the agoraphobia word, because like words have a lot of power to me, you know.
And
you know, I have a life coach, and she said to me, "Look, you are. It's in the past, now you just have to kind of change your lens and kind of go, look, I'm overwhelmed.
Have you found is there a trigger somewhere? Was it the teenage years or?
God, I don't know. I mean, I think like as a teenager, I would have been pretty quiet, which might surprise some people. But I think, you know, when like before I had the first panic attack in Dublin, I was kind of up and down to Dublin a lot and had planned to move to Dublin. And I don't know, look, I if I look back and kind of go, oh, maybe this is why. Like, I did spend a lot of time going, oh, maybe this is why and maybe this is why. And then I just kind of went, it happens, you know.
But you had a panic attack in Dublin.
Yeah, I had like a panic attack on a night out. And then that kind of shook me for a few weeks. Had another one in Waterford where I was like, oh, that just feels very strange, kind of out of body.
Okay.
I think they call it like depersonalization and derealization, which are kind of separate things anyway. And then when I did eventually move to Dublin, like I literally lasted like 4 days because I knew before I left Waterford that there was something amiss.
Mm.
But I kind of did that typical Irish male thing of just ignoring it.
Mm.
And then it just built up and built up. And, you know, there
did
was
you get to talk to anyone who also was agoraphobic? Did you ever get to meet people?
No, I didn't actually. Like I was aware what agoraphobia was because I'm a soap fan, so I've seen storylines done and, you know, and I was aware straight away. I knew straight away. And I remember in 2009 when my dad had been to see Mark Rowe and he came back and he had it written down on a piece of paper, agoraphobia. And I was
like, you couldn't go.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah.
Was there a specific room you stayed in the house or was it?
Oh, like, in terms of like when I was housebound, like I wasn't restricted to like a room or anything like that.
Yeah, I think people have kind of assumptions of what happens when
you're agoraphobic. Yeah, it was just like, it's kind of like a blur, those 3 years. You know, I always say as well, like, you know, I've been very lucky in that, oh yeah, it was tough, unbelievably tough. And sometimes you kind of want to just kind of, right, don't want to kind of think about that. But also, like, I'm lucky in the sense that I have a great family and I never got to a point where I was, like, wanting to end anything or anything. Because I always kind of knew at the back of my mind, look, this will pass. And it took a long time to pass, believe me.
And a lot of work.
Obviously. A lot of work. But like, when I look back on the last, like, 7 years, you know, from the broadcast course to now, it's just, like, kind of been crazy. Like, I really...
Because, you know, it's not that... You decided to go and do a regular 9-to-5 when you were able to leave the house. You decided to perform. And I don't know if agoraphobia and performance mix.
Yeah, it's strange because like even with the family, like they always say to me, like, you know, they'd often kind of say, well, will we go for a spin here or a spin there? And I'd kind of be quite hesitant and they'll kind of say, you know, oh, how come you can get up in a room full of people and rattle off homes and we can't get you on the M, whatever. And like, it's a different thing. But I mean, with the performance and spoken word, it was just like a happy accident, really. You know, I was doing the radio course and I kind of thought I'd get my foot in with Beat. And then I did my first performance with Mod Words with Anna Jordan. And I was just like, I think this is what I'm more suited to.
Amazing. You know? And it's got to the stage where you have been invited to perform in different counties and at festivals, and that's when your agoraphobia has kind of come back and reared its head again, hasn't it?
Yeah, like, I mean, like last summer I was invited to perform at Talkatives in Dublin, which is like a massive spoken word event, and Electric Picnic, and they both kind of came out of the blue, really. I mean with Talkatives, there's a great poet called, I hope I pronounced his name right, the Gago Hart.
Okay.
Amazing poet, and he asked me and I couldn't, I just explained the situation, and I remember the next day being gutted. Did again the typical Irish thing of going out drinking for the day, and then when Electric Picnic happened, that was like last June, completely random because I didn't think I was on their radar at all because I'm from Waterford, and like, you know, I look back and I kind of regret that I kind of made it public. But then I think to myself, well, hang on, you got asked to do the biggest festival in the country,
exactly.
Of course you're going to tell everyone. And it was just like weeks of building up and kind of going. In my head, I was like, you know, now you haven't been over the bridge in a long time and you're expecting yourself to go up to Strad Valley in Laois. It just didn't happen.
Couldn't do it.
And, you know, the lads from Electric Picnic were, you know, they're really, really kind and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed for you now. And do you feel stronger as time goes on?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think I'm definitely the happiest I've been, I think, ever. Really, the last 7 years, I think I'm definitely the happiest I've been and the most kind of true to myself, I suppose. So, I mean, I'm happiest when I'm working, writing. You know, that's where I want. That's just where I'm at right now. I want to keep performing, more plays, more books. If I can afford to buy a house, I'm happy. And after that, then it's just a bonus. So, you know.
Will we talk about Dress You Up? Because it was shown last year at Bank Lane, at four sold out nights in Bank Lane and Waterford. So people might know it. It's set in a just iconic time, the summer of 1997, when we were all either Baby, Posh Spice, whoever you wanted to be. Spice Girls were in full swing. And tell us about this.
Yeah, so Dress You Up, the title is inspired by a Madonna song.
Yeah, Dress You Up.
There's a lot of Madonna. So basically, it goes back to the summer of 1997, and you follow Bobby Burke, who's 16 years of age. He's just lost his mother the summer before, and he wants to be a drag queen. Mm-hmm. And obviously he's gay as well, but kind of the main arc of the story is him kind of finding himself and being able to actually get up and perform publicly as his drag persona.
Okay.
He's also obsessed with Madonna, so there's a big sprinkling of Madonna throughout the play. He's got best friend Mandy, who played by Evie Burke. All the cast are amazing, I'll give them all a mention. But she's got her own storyline going on, and the Auntie Karen is probably the only person in his family that knows, you know, he's gay and wants to be a drag queen. So you follow him that summer. He's got like his tormentor, Decky Flynn, very kind of stereotypical kind of bully from the late 90s, very homophobic, has had that kind of instilled in him by his mother, Bernie, who was heard a lot from in the play but never seen. And she's kind of like an avatar for the kind of, you know, the kind of religious bigotry and, you know, homophobia that would have existed back then, and still does, to be quite honest. It just goes back to that time in 1997, and you just follow him over that summer, and you're kind of just rooting for him, kind of wondering, you know, is the end result that he'd actually get up and perform? I'm looking forward to.
Is there a little bit of yourself in there?
I think the Madonna thing definitely is me. I can't deny that. I've never wanted to be a drag queen. Okay. I did do it before in the Cheetah Royal.
I seem to remember that.
My drag name is Dua Slap after Dua Lipa. And I actually did lip sync to Vogue very badly.
That was a classic one to do. I hope you did the box.
I tried to do all that and the little muscle flex, which I'm getting David Martin, who's playing Bobby, trying to get him to do all that. So, I think there's a little bit of me in terms of, like, you know, Bobby's coming out journey and the kind of fear he has. And also, like I said, the Madonna references and the 90s stuff as well. So, I'm delighted it's in the Theatre Royal.
Sounds great. Good stuff. It's on July 11th in the Theatre Royal, theatreroyal.ie, if you want to check that out. Where can people see your spoken word stuff and everything?
If you want to, like, see kind of, like, daily poems and stuff, like facebook.com Wayne Power Poetry, instagram.com Wayne Power Poetry, and Wayne the next Power gig Poetry is in Garter Lane on May 30th for The Words Out in the Basement on O'Connell Street. And Slip of the Tongue, the night I do, that should be back in the summer. Couple of gigs then, I think there's one in October in Philly Grimes's. And might be one or two before then, hopefully.
Brilliant stuff. Well, fair play to you. Thanks a million for telling us your story this morning. That's Wayne Power Poetry, if you want to check out Wayne's brilliant poetry and spoken word stuff as well. Thanks a million for coming
on
this
morning. Thanks, Orla. Thank you.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
This is Sunday Grill. You're listening to Beat, and I don't need to tell anyone this, but the Leaving Cert and Junior Cert are only around the corner. We've all been there. The deep prep or the cramming, I don't know what sort of person you were, but I was the latter. But no matter how often students are told it's not the be all and end all, it's natural to be worried and stressed out for both parents and students. Well, Dan Sheedy is the principal at the tuition centre, and he has practical lists of do's and don'ts for students as they get ready to head to the exam halls. Oh, I remember it well, Dan, do you?
Oh, I do remember it well, but I look at it with fondness now, because we would never have a summer if it wasn't for the Leaving Cert. So,
well, true.
We have to be thankful.
As in, we wouldn't have good weather.
Oh, it's the best weather, sure. God bless it. No Leaving Cert, we'd have an awful summer.
So, I had two Leaving Certs.
Sorry to all the students out there. Grown-ups are delighted to see the Leaving Cert coming. We know we'll get a bit of...
Well, don't get too cheeky there and rubbing it in, because the karma people could be thinking, let's give them bad weather for this year's Leaving Cert. So we'll leave it there, Dan. I did two Leaving Certs, Dan. I repeated. And to tell you the truth, the first one is just a blur because it was so stressful. It almost, you know, I didn't feel as stressed about the second time around.
It is difficult. I actually have my own daughter sitting the Leaving Cert this year, so I'm viewing it from... Yeah, I viewed it from a teacher's viewpoint for 25 years, but I'll tell you, it's a very different viewpoint as a parent, you know, and girls in particular, they do get very stressed.
I think girls get a bit stressed even a bit earlier. Has that changed some of the advice that you're giving people and seeing your own daughter going through it?
Oh, I would say not so much seeing my own daughter come through it. Actually, the minute you become a parent, you definitely teach differently.
Yeah.
Any teacher out there will tell you that, you know, the manner in which you teach students from the moment, never mind when your child is 18 in the Leaving Cert, really from the moment your child is born, you definitely, teachers will always, it just affects you. I think being a parent affects every facet of your life, but certainly as a teacher, it changed how I taught.
Totally. And gives you more empathy
You definitely have a bit more empathy. There's no doubt about it. You have a bit more empathy and you become a better teacher for it. I think being a parent probably makes you a better person in all facets of life, and it certainly meant me a better teacher, I would say anyway. My daughter might disagree, but
we'll have to get her on and ask her. It also, I suppose we've all forgotten about what we were like as students. Like, definitely in third level, I was, you know, I really took advantage of being independent of my parents and not having to go to class and stuff. It kind of makes us forget what it's like to be a student back then. And the Leaving Cert especially can be so, so stressful. And you have a list of do's that we all kind of know, like planning your study, turn up for those final classes, look after your well-being, make time for your family and friends, and being organised. But can we have a look at the don'ts that you have put together at the Tuition Centre, Dan? Because they're quite interesting. And I think when it's this time of year, we are thinking about our well-being and ensuring that we have a certain amount of hours in, but we're not thinking about the things that we shouldn't be doing. And one of them, and I was so terrible about this, was don't believe the predictions.
Yeah, I suppose we be careful how we say it, but like it's obviously at the Tuition Centre, we operate completely in an online space. And predictions are good. Every student loves predictions. I taught geography for 25 years. I always give predictions. Predictions are fine, but there's two things students really need to be cognizant about predictions. Number one, these are guesses, not guarantees. You know, I mean, I make out mock papers. There couldn't be anyone probably more experienced in geography, and I do not know what's coming up in the answer. You know, students really want to know that there's this secret out there, that some people are in the know. They're not. So number one, you have to know that predictions are guesses, not guarantees. And number two, unfortunately, where you get them from is becoming more and more important. There's a lot of people in the online space now. They're not really concerned with students. They're about getting clicks. They're about getting views. Many of them aren't even teachers. So I would say to students, of course, look for predictions. It's a lovely thing. But just make sure you're getting them off teachers and experienced teachers. And then don't put all your eggs in that basket. You know, I mean, we're human. We're all going to look for a little shortcut. And shortcuts are fine. But if you've someone on social media who's never taught a class in their life saying, I heard that these are going to come up, that's quite dangerous for students. And students are very vulnerable at this time of the year, and they will believe that. So I would say, of course, look for predictions, but source them from, you know, really experienced teachers. And even then, don't put all your eggs in that basket.
Okay, good stuff. Then you're saying don't compare yourselves to others as well. And I do think there's an awful lot of chat about study hours and things at this time of year, isn't there? And how much people have done or haven't done.
Yeah, I think that, like it was a Shakespeare, comparisons are odious. Like, I mean, what I would say to students, and again, I've experienced with this, is it doesn't matter what your friend is doing. I mean, there's a great story I taught my students that when I was in secondary school, I remember there was this fella in school with me, and this guy made it look so easy, Orla. You know, I mean, it was H1s, A1s back in the day in every class, 600 points in the Leaving Cert. And I remember looking, I have to work so hard. This guy has it so easy. But then I met him later in college, and I remember saying to him, how did you make it so easy? He says, I didn't. He says, you were playing sport. I didn't play sport. I had to study. You were doing music. I didn't do that. You were out at the weekends enjoying yourself. I didn't do that. And I remember looking back thinking, well, I wish I'd known that then.
Yeah.
You know, that I was comparing myself to someone who really didn't have it that easy. He was working so hard, and I wouldn't have been prepared to give up my sport. I love my sport. So you can look at someone and say, oh, it seems so easy to them. They're going to get 600 points. They're getting H1s in every test. It doesn't matter about that. What matters is once the Leaving Cert is over, you as a student is going to have a bunch of points in your hands, and you've earned those points.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if they're 370, 470, 270, or 570. They're yours. And you worked hard to get those points. And what matters then is what you do with them. I've seen people get 600 points and not use them. I've seen people get 370 points and go on and make phenomenal careers from results. So this comparison of, you know, I need to get this. And I had this with my daughter. She says to me, you know, but I need to get a H2 in biology. I says, no. You don't say I need to get it. You focus on the process.
Yes.
Do your best today.
You'd like to get it.
Do your best tomorrow. Exactly. And it will arrive at the end of the process. Mm-hmm. Am I doing my best today? Am I doing the best tomorrow? Will I do the best in the exam? Then you'll arrive at the result at the end. But the last thing I'll say on that, like, is you'd hear students saying, oh, I need to get 560 points, right? Because they want a course that's 560, that's natural. But then if that student gets 550, they feel like they've failed.
Uh-huh.
Whereas 550 is an absolutely stunning leave insert. 470 is a phenomenal leave insert. But if they say, I need to get my course at 490, I need 490 points, they view 485 as a failure. And it isn't. It's a stunning achievement. So comparisons are odious. Don't compare yourself with other kids. And don't be saying, I need to get this. Mm. You're going to get exactly what you deserve. And you're going to do great with it.
What you're trying to say is, as our mothers would say, what's meant to be won't pass you by.
That's it. But up in Clare, we'd say, what for you won't pass you.
Exactly. Now, at the complete opposite end, you're saying, don't let those people who seem to not care about the Leaving Cert at all drag you down.
Yeah, I used to always say this when I was teaching Leaving Cert classes, that once the sun comes out in May, these people will kind of rise up. Now, there's nothing wrong. These might be people who don't want to go to third level. That's perfectly fine. Third level isn't for everyone. In fact, some people shouldn't go. They might be people who do want to go to third level but haven't worked any all year and they know they're in trouble as they come to the last few weeks. And they're the ones who say, Ara, come on, let's go out at the weekend or let's leave school early or let's do this and let's do that. You know, and I have a friend who works in the pensions business and what they say is stick to the plan.
Yeah.
So I would say to student, try and avoid those people who are pulling you away from what you want to do.
Yeah.
And they do, when the sun comes out, we joked about it at the start. It's so hard. It's so hard. I watched my daughter the last 2 weeks up in the room and the sun splitting the rocks. Mm-hmm. You know, the temptation to, and they're inches from that freedom. They're inches from that adulthood. They're so close to that adulthood and that freedom from us parents that they can feel it. The temptation is to, oh, I'm going to go now and get out in the sun and enjoy myself. It's so hard. It's
so
easy
hard
for me in the radio to say stick to the plan.
Exactly.
You know,
and if you have some fella who could be getting up at 5 a.m. himself to do his study and then saying he's doing nothing and going out and enjoying the sunshine, that sort of pressure is not something that you need on the run up to this exam.
Do you know, you're spot on. And that's another point I didn't consider. You're spot on. Very often the people who are saying, come on, let's go, they've already done their work.
Exactly.
You know, and is people learn differently. You know, I used to get up at 9 a.m. in college and study in the morning, whereas I can see my daughter, she's an evening study person.
Yeah.
So
there you
everyone's
go.
Different.
Yeah, people talk to the talk. Is the junior search as stressful in your opinion? Are you experiencing this level of worry? I can't remember being that worried about my junior search.
No, and again, I'm so lucky to be in the wonderful position of having a daughter doing Leaving Cert and a son doing junior search.
Wow, okay.
And the comparisons are incomparable.
Mm.
I don't think my son has picked up a book yet. He will. You know, he'll get away with it. But it is the junior cycle exam, or in recent years, it's become more of a slightly lower stakes than it used to be in our day.
And what would you say to people who might still feel that level of pressure? Like, it's not about going to university. So is it the same kind of deal? Like, study when you can, don't listen to the naysayers.
It is. I think a junior cycle, it's healthy in a way, because what it is, it's a bit of personal pressure kids will put themselves under. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, exams, we've been an awful lot of talk, Laura, in Ireland the last few years about the changes coming to the Leaving Cert and how the Leaving Cert is X and how it's Y and how it's terrible. Now, I wouldn't be, and the same is applicable to junior cycle, I wouldn't be as against the Leaving Cert as a lot of people.
Okay.
And the reason for that would be we're investing an awful lot correctly in what is termed now resilience. You'll have heard that yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching resilience, teaching our kids resilience. And that is important because the world is a difficult place. It was much easier for me to grow up as an 18 to 25 year old than any child today. I think they have it much harder. So they do need to develop this resilience. But if you look at the Leaving Cert exam, and it's a challenge.
Yeah.
And it's a stressful challenge. And for months before, it's stressful and you question yourself.
Okay.
But the good thing about the Leaving Cert is when you come out the other end of it, you can look back and say, well, there was a challenge in my life. I got through it. And the way I got through it was by working really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does prepare them. I meet so many past pupils in second and third year in college. And what they do say is, well, you know, the exams in college are grand because I did the Leaving Cert.
Of course.
And I knew that if I could get through that, you know, so what it does is it builds resilience, certainly academically. Now, do we need to change the Leaving Cert? Of course, the Leaving Cert needs to be changed. Of course, there needs to be way more pathways for people for whom that journey isn't applicable.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who are moving down that journey, that academic journey, there is an element of, this does work in terms of it does build resilience. And a small amount of stress for students, that is a good thing, because life is stressful.
True.
You know, and we need to learn to deal with stress.
Exactly.
And the Leaving Cert does that. It does a bit of that,
yeah,
definitely.
Totally. And like you said, resilience seems to be the key when it comes to, you know, being able to live anxiety-free almost and not catastrophizing and all that. Having a bit of resilience helps with that. The tuitioncentre.ie is where you will find Dan and plenty of other teachers and tutors that can help you along the way on your journey in the Junior Cert and Leaving Cert. That is the tuitioncentre.ie, and Dan is the principal at that centre. Dan, thanks for that brilliant advice. Advice I could take into my own life, even though I will never ever do an exam for the rest of my life.
I think I'm in that boat with you, Orla.
Thanks, Dan. Happy Leaving Cert to your daughter and Junior Cert to your son, and thanks a million for talking to me this morning.
Thank you, it's a real pleasure. Take care.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
There you go. There, that is music from Alex Warren and Ella Henderson on Beat, and that is Carry You Home. Well, let's chat Pride, because we're flying towards the summertime and all those events that you have to look forward to, including lots of Pride celebrations. John Paul Payne is deep in organisation mode for Carlow's Pride, and we talked to him. What was that? Was that 8 years ago, did you say, John Paul, for the very first one?
Yes.
Imagine.
It was. I spoke to you. I think you were the very first radio interview we ever had. I was so nervous. I drove my little car down to Waterbury.
And there was a load of you, wasn't there?
Yeah. So that was 8 years ago.
Wow. Yeah. Imagine. Yeah. And now look at, I'm not talking, I think there was four of you in studio chatting about it then. But look, it's just you and me today. And you're going to tell us about some of the things that you've planned for Carlow's Pride. You're deep in organisation, as I said. It's on July 13th. And, you know, this is the week 10 years ago that Ireland became the first country to approve same-sex marriage by a whopping 1.2 million people saying yes to marriage equality. So what better time to talk about some of the many Pride events that we have around the Southeast? Because once it was just Dublin, wasn't it, John Paul?
Yeah, it was. And that's a great point, actually, because this week is 10 years and I was one of those voters.
Yeah.
And I lived in Canada and I flew home from Canada vote that day. Can you imagine that? That's how important I was to all of us around the world.
Of course. So you were there when the yes came in Dublin Castle.
I was there, the yes came, and I flew out the next day. And I remember I didn't drink. And I remember being in Paris and seeing it on the news in Paris.
Wow.
Yeah.
How amazing. What an amazing experience as well. And so, here you are home in Carlow.
Yes. And home in Carlow, and we're here. We are planning the next Pride for 2025. We've so much happening at the moment, and we have new members on our committee. We have the amazing Out magazine that we have, that's going to be featured in Carlow Nationalist and hopefully other publications around Ireland. So this year we are literally bursting with colour. So the whole town is going to come into a rave celebration.
Okay.
We have live music, incredible performances, food, art. Now we have a few surprises.
Okay, I hear you have a headline act, but you're not going to tell us who or
so
who
I
they
will
are.
Say,
okay, go on.
Yes, I will commit. I will commit to live on air now with you that I will come back and reveal it exclusively with you.
Okay, and when will that be?
Good. That will be in about 3 weeks.
Okay,
time.
I look forward to that. Can you give us a hint, even?
Yeah. Oh, if I, you know what it is, the person, yeah, I can't, because I'm so bad at hints, I probably just blurt out.
It's Madonna.
And I've been warned, because we have the social media kind of images done already, and like I'm dying to share them with people. So I've been banned from having the images.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But you do know who the headline act is?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay. Never want to know. Yeah, yeah. So and every year we have like a kind of a new idea or a new theme or a new direction. And this year I feel like we are hitting everything right. We're getting everything done. We're having a lot of fun doing it. We have loads of new members on our committee. The weather has been amazing. So
yes,
we feel like
crossed.
We feel like we're celebrating Pride already, you know, in lead up to it. But yes, so don't worry, I will come back on and let you know, so you won't want to miss it.
Brilliant. Now, I presume from living in Canada and, you know, going to Dublin, you've been to plenty of prides. How does the Carlow Pride compare? What does a regional pride really, what does it do differently?
So we are really different to other larger prides. So if people haven't attended a smaller pride, we are completely free. We don't charge a ticket at any part of it. We hold it on a Sunday, so there's more parking. There's no paying for parking. And also, we have it in a civic centre in Carlow, which is never really used. So the park in Carlow Town Park was designed for this exact reason, to hold festivals and all this kind of thing. And I think we were the very first festival to ever hold a festival in that. And it was built maybe 15 years ago. Now, I could be wrong on that. Some might email in and say, oh, no, there was something there. But, you know, we are using it to its full capacity. 4,000 people turn up on a Sunday in July, hopefully a sunny Sunday in July. And we also, we support local acts. So a lot of people that you will see on our stage are from the town. All the singers and songwriters, the superstars that we have on the stage, they're showcasing Carlow at its very best. Last year, we had people come over from America. We had people come over from Germany just for our event. We had never met them before. So we do have a large impact locally here. We're really welcoming, we're really warm. It's a fun day for everybody. Now, it's a no-drink event, so we specifically want to have a no-drink event, so it's safe for everyone to attend. You know, there's loads of reasons you can go out and have a drink at any other place, and this is going to be an event where you come, have some food, get some culture, look at some art, hear some great songs, dance in the park, and have a great day, and then go home and wake up next day for work and feel perfect.
Did you expect to still be doing it 8 years on, or were you going to have it as a one-off?
You know, 8 years ago, when I spoke to you, we had no concept of what was ahead of us. And I, in my mind back then, I remember thinking it's going to be me and six other people with a flag on our back because we're only 6 days in Carlow. and
people, that's just Carlow Town.
People had emailed me and said there's only 6 days in Carlow. Like, who's going to walk with you? So, and that obviously that sits in your mind, right? So I thought to myself, like, you know, it's going to be just us. And then on the day, 3,500 people turned up to walk the streets.
What a buzz. Amazing. Do you feel that, you know, even like we're joking about, you know, the only gay in the village type joke, but it must be so important for people who don't feel, you know, the connection or community that you get from a capital city or a big city.
Totally.
It must be so important.
Totally. And I suppose early on we realised how important it was to people, because people saw Carlow Pride Festival getting traction online, and people who had moved away because they were gay to Dublin or to Cork or to Singapore or Japan or Australia, and they hadn't come back because of how they were treating Carlow, they had a really strange emotional connection to Carlow Pride Festival. They were worried about it happening. They were excited about it happening. They were upset about it happening. They were emotional on so many levels. And I suppose we didn't realise the impact that we would have in that space. If we look at how it's kind of impacted Carlow now at the moment, you know, what we're saying is you can live in Carlow. You can be successful. You can be really great at your job. You can open a business here. You don't have to go to a big city now anymore to be who you are.
So important to hear that as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I work here in Carlow. I work all over the world. I work in many major cities. I work in Dublin. But I have a studio here in Carlow. I work in Carlow. I'm very proud to be from Carlow. My parents still live here. Mm-hmm. I grew up here. It's like I always thought when I was growing up, I'm going to move away and I'm going to live far, far. And I moved to California and I got a house in Beverly Hills and I thought, here we are. And I got there and thought, God, I was so depressed.
Okay.
I was so sad when I got there. I was thinking, God, I miss Carlow. I miss a bit of bacon and cabbage. No one told me this. You can't get it in Beverly Hills.
Oh, you definitely couldn't get it in Beverly Hills. You can get everything else, I'd say.
I wouldn't know what Biletown was, I'm telling you.
We're going to have to talk about your experience of living in California when you come and you tell us about that headliner, because we're almost running out of time. And I want to chat to you about the fundraising you're doing at the moment. So you are fundraising for Pride. How can people get involved?
So, you know, we like things to be paid for directly. So it saves us from having to organise things. So if people want to reach out and they have maybe a business that prints signs, or they have a business that does flags, or they have a business that does leaflets, or they have like some sort of IT business, or they work in IT, or they want to volunteer with us, they can reach out to me at johnpaul@carlopridefest.ie.
Okay.
If people want to volunteer at our events, the Carlow Volunteer Centre look after all of our volunteer opportunities. So in the next couple of weeks, they will have Carlow Pride Festival's volunteer portal opened. So you can apply directly to them and then we will get touch base with you after that.
That's a great idea. It's a great way to meet people as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so last year we had 50 people volunteer with us. About 40 of them I've never met before. So now I've 40 new friends.
Brilliant. And hopefully a new few new couples out of that as well.
Well, funny you should say that, because there is a couple that came out of Carlow Pride Festival last year.
Love to hear it. They're engaged. Yeah. Brilliant news.
Yes.
Oh, that's great to hear. Well, let's give that email again. It's johnpaul@carlowpridefest.ie. And then if people want to volunteer, they go on to, what's the website they go on to?
It's the Carlow Volunteer Centre.
Carlow Volunteer Centre, and you can register your details there. And then Pride, of course, in Carlow Town is on July 13th. You'll get more details at Carlow Pride Festival on social media. John Paul, in about 3 weeks' time, we'll talk about who that headline act is on July 13th. You'll tell us all about life in California. And you've lots of people that you've done their makeup for down through the years. So we'll have to hear some of those stories as well.
Absolutely.
And I'm not talking the run-of-the-mill Joe Soaps. You've had some famous faces.
Yes.
Brushing the faces of some famous faces.
Very famous people.
Oh,
yeah,
we will do that in a few weeks' time. But in the meantime, that is Carlow Pride, July 13th. You'll find them all over social media. And if you want to volunteer, it's the Carlow Volunteer Centre. John Paul, it's always lovely to talk to you. Chat to you again soon.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
Well, some new stats coming out of the world of weddings. Henparty.ie contacted 12 wedding bands, asked them what the top three songs couples most often requested for their first dance. They got 36 answers, but the number one, two and three is... At number three, Frankie Valli's Can't Take My Eyes Off You. Number two is the Cranberries Dreams even. And number one was Codeline with The One. So that got me thinking, if my Beat colleagues were to get married, what would be their first dance?
I'm not in a relationship, so I feel like it needs to be like something sentimental with the person that you're going to marry. So I need to meet that person first.
So you have thought about your song to walk down the aisle?
Yeah, so the song to walk down the aisle to is Ed Sheeran, Tenerife Sea, and the harps, and oh, it's just perfect.
Sing it there.
No.
Okay, so you're the only married person that I know here, Shona Lyons from Beat Breakfast. What was your first dance?
Let's Get It On.
Oh, by Marvin Gaye.
That one, yeah. Although my inspiration was...
Let's Get It On.
I've been really trying. The inspiration was James Arthur, because he was on X Factor at the time and we used to watch it every Saturday night. Not Tom. Myself and my mum used to watch it, but she rang me one Saturday night and said, James Arthur is just after doing a brilliant version of Let's Get It On. That'd be the perfect first dance song. I don't really think she knows what first dance songs are, because suddenly I said it a couple of years ago on Beat Breakfast, and then Niall has since like dined out on the fact that I did that with my like great aunt and my like in-laws watching us.
But, and yet the only bit I can remember is Let's Get It On.
Yeah, I don't really, it's a bit of a blur, that dance. I think we got people to come on to the dance floor because it's quite embarrassing. Now that you say it, it's mortifying. But there was no grinding.
Good. I'm glad to hear. Not really a wedding thing, grinding. Killian, what would be your dance?
Oh, I've got a brilliant one, right? And it's going to be an actual dance. I'm having none of this bridesmaids coming out and stealing the spotlight off me. It's going to be Can I Have This Dance from High School Musical 3. Troy and Gabriella on the top in the rain did like a full dance.
Oh, so you're going to learn the dance. You're going to be the star.
Oh, yeah.
And what about your future wife?
Still on the hunt for a future wife. It's just I need to find someone who can dance. That's I have them all queued up and lined up for me. That's just the only problem.
Okay. Dana's looking for a husband and she can dance. Aoife, first dance, not walking down the aisle.
First dance, I think Queen, You're My Best Friend, because it's such a cute song. And do you want all the rest of the songs for the wedding? Because I have kind of thought about this a lot.
You're okay.
I'm not engaged, by the way.
So do you think you'll have to do a bit of a fast dance? Will you have to learn a routine with your future husband? Or is it just going to be a bit of a waltz?
I think You're My Best Friend is a little bit of a boppy one. It's not too soppy. So I don't know if it actually requires too much dance moves. I'd say I'd have a job to move the person I assume I will marry around the dance floor to begin with. So something kind of, you know, that doesn't require too much movement. I wouldn't be doing a flash mob now or anything.
Brian, my favourite person. You're getting married in the morning. What is your first dance song?
My first dance song? Africa by Toto. It's very romantic. Gonna take a lot to drag me away from you.
Sing it for me.
Gonna take a lot to drag me away from you. There's nothing that 100 men or more can ever do.
I bless the rains down in Africa. Gonna take some time to do the things we never did.
So are you going to do waltz? Are you going to shimmy? What are you going to do?
Like 1920s jazz.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've thought this through. Dean, it's your first dance at your wedding. What is it?
Oh, God. I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Oh! Jesus Christ.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rapple on Beat 102-103.
It's a Sunday morning here on Beat and Ethan Hunt is back. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. That's what it's called. But do we believe it? Is it The Final Reckoning for Tom Cruise? Because he's done 8 of them and he loves a stunt.
Oh, trust me, this movie will prove to you he loves a stunt.
Okay. Will it prove to me that it's the last one?
I don't know.
Okay.
Does anything ever end, Orla?
Well, not in this capitalist world. It's been almost 30 years since the first Mission Impossible, 1996, meaning that Tom Cruise has spent... Is that the year you were born?
Yeah.
Oh, meaning Tom Cruise has spent nearly half of his life doing mad stunts. He's leapt off cliffs, jumped onto planes, run across trains, you know? Let's have a listen to Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. And then Brian, who's never done any of those stunts, will really harshly,
know?
I just know, will really harshly judge him. Here we go.
This can't all be true.
Every word. CIA Black Vault break-in.
Am I reading this correctly? The Kremlin bombing?
In fairness, the bomb was actually meant to kill him.
He gassed a security briefing. That was just 2 months ago.
This explains the handcuffs. It's still not clear why he's here.
If we want to bring the world back from the brink, we have to deal with him.
Should he choose to accept?
Smart people on every side are close to panicking.
What exactly is your plan?
There you go. That is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. I'm trying to think of how many Mission Impossibles I've seen, and two is... I can remember going to them.
Okay.
They're not... You're not going to remember the storyline or anything. It's not that sort of a movie.
Yeah, kind of. It's kind of just an experience.
Is this something you enjoy, Mission Impossible?
Do you know, it's an interesting thing because normally action movies, I'm not really... Like, they're like, okay, they're grand or whatever. Like, normally the comedy is what kind of shines through for me, but Mission Impossible is the exception to that. I think they're phenomenal. Like,
oh, good.
Only until before the last one I actually watched through them. I'd never seen most of them.
Okay.
And
so you watched the 1996 one?
Yeah.
Like, how does it... Like, I know it's going to look different. It's nearly 30 years.
It's an interesting thing because the Mission Impossible things are one of the only movies that come out that recognize the audience's intelligence.
In what way?
That they know you've seen everything before.
Okay.
And, like, in every other action movie... plan always works.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, they're such a good thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Mission Impossible, the plan always goes wrong.
Okay.
And the whole thing is about adapting to what's going on and what's happening at the minute. And like, just you have to keep going because there's no time to like style your way out of it. You have to just get out of it. And like, you get injured and people have the injuries carry on. Do you know what I mean? It's so unique in that way. And it's so like, obviously Tom Cruise nearly dies every movie just trying to get a good stunt. And like, that alone is worth the price of the ticket.
Tom Cruise being Ethan Hunt in this. Tom Cruise himself, though, in all these stunts, has suffered a broken ankle, cracked ribs and a torn shoulder, which sounds absolutely horrific. So what sort of things is he doing in this eighth Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning?
Like, because you know he does them, it makes you think, like, he could have died doing this.
Yeah, like, he can hold his breath for over 6 minutes.
Mm, and he did, like, in that movie before where he was doing that mission where he went through the water, he actually did hold his breath for the entirety of that length. But in this, he's holding onto a submarine. And, like, I don't know if it's real or not, but knowing him, it probably is to an extent. And there's ones where he's holding onto planes. And I was like, well, this can't be.
And it is.
And then you see the footage and it's like, wow. The guy he's in the scene with isn't in it, which is, like, fair enough because he's flying upside down in the middle of the sky. But Tom Cruise is hanging on to the side of a plane. Now, he does have a cable attached to him that's edited out, which makes me feel happier.
Yeah.
But other than that, he is just holding on to the side of a plane as it's flying. And it's like, that is insane. Do you know, like, it's the stunt work that he does. Like, I know there's crazy stunts happen, but the stunt work that he does is just next level.
Phenomenal.
And
I'm not going to, you know, he is a certain age, but he is a phenomena, really.
Yo,
in
like,
his 60s to be but able even to still do these things.
There's scenes when he's just running and you're like, wow. I couldn't do that.
Couldn't do that. Tell us the storyline behind this one. And lots of really recognisable faces and the usual Hannah, what is her surname from the football series?
Hannah Waddingham.
She is in so many things at the moment. When she pops up, I go, ah, there she is again now.
So
A smaller role, I find.
Yeah, but it's kind of one of those things where she's only still like an emerging star as well. But the whole Mission Impossible series has been, let's get some of the most talented actors from all different genres to come and be in this show, in this movie. And like, they've had Philip Seymour Hoffman, they've had like some of the greatest villains you'll ever see in movies. But like Simon Pegg, one of my all-time favourite actors.
Yeah,
in
great
there.
Stuff.
Tom Cruise, as we were saying. Angela Bassett is the president.
Star.
Phenomenal. Like, she carries this kind of elegance you need to as a president. She carries that power with her.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, sometimes you're like, oh, this is just a random dude as president. You need to have a big name in there. And I feel like every role in this, people would be delighted to be. Like, it's one of those movies. It's interesting because it's a franchise that if you ask any actor to be in Mission Impossible, you'd be like, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Because Henry Cavill has been in it before, Rebecca Ferguson, like Hayley Atwell's in it this time. Bing Rames is in it again. Palm Clementiff, which I don't know if you know, is Mantis in like Guardians of the Galaxy. Is probably what she's most known for.
Give us a bit of a plot there, though. What's going on?
So it's part two of a movie that came out a few years ago. But that doesn't really matter.
Okay.
You don't like, if you've seen the previous movie, great. Like, you know exactly what's happening. But this movie is like, if they refer to something, they'll show like a quick clip of that.
Okay.
So it's like, if you've never seen a Mission Impossible before, you can just start on this one.
Right.
Despite it having like 30 years of lore behind it. That's what I'm saying. It respects the audience because it's like, they're not expecting you to have seen every movie that came out over the last 29 years.
Yeah, and there's a bit of arrogance in that, isn't there? I see that with an awful lot of like the Marvel stuff, that you're almost expected to know everything that's happening these little nuggets.
You didn't watch this one episode of a TV show, you won't know who this person is and why this person died and sad. Like this, you feel everything. Because I haven't seen any of Mission Impossible since the last one came out, which is a couple of years ago now.
Okay.
I think it could be 3 or 4 years ago even. And I couldn't remember where people stood, but it reminds you.
Okay.
It tells you.
Tell me what's happening.
Yeah, well, there's this thing called The Entity. It's a big AI thing, and it's taken over the world. It's gradually taken over all the nuclear missile silos. And once it has it all, either it gets into the whole data and it has control of everything, or it blows up the world.
Okay.
And it's like, there's no bad guy in another country. It's purely AI. So everything they use has to be...
They love a bit of AI these days, don't they?
No, but this does it so well because they really go with everything has to be analog. So the planes have to be analog and the communication has to be analog. So do you know the way in movies, sometimes a phone can make things too easy?
Yeah.
They can't use the phone because in the last movie, it shows the AI can use people's voices. And he can be on a phone call and it's like, it's not who you think they're on a phone. So they can't trust a single person.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to do everything in person and everything's written on paper and they're using like old school cars. And it's just so kind of like a classic spy movie, but also like wicked stunts. Like it's just fantastic, honestly. Like it's the people is what make it. Like, because it's normally these things like James Bond can do everything on his own.
Mm.
Like, Ethan Hunt needs a team. Like, he does parts of it and he does crazy bits of it. Like, he does the maddest bits. But on his own, they lose.
And you can see it's a really ensemble. And even the clip that we played back there, like, there's so, you know, usually when there's such a big star in a movie, all the promos and the clips are that big star.
Yeah.
In this Mission Impossible, it actually, it was a long time before I even saw Ethan Hunt in it.
But the interesting thing is, again, like, this isn't this, like, the whole thing of Hollywood movies at the minute is who's in it. Mm. You know, like, well, how big are the names in it? The bigger the name surely means better the movie. And as we've seen over the past however many years I've been chatting away to you, that does not mean anything.
That doesn't straight away mean so, nominations and money coming in.
Mission Impossible says this is what happens in the movie and these people happen to be in it.
Okay.
Rather than these people are in the movie and this is what they do. No, like, these are the crazy things you're going to see. Oh, also Tom Cruise is in it.
Oh, I like that. Do you know,
so
idea.
It's like,
yeah,
it's the way to do it. It's the way, like, I don't know, like, Top Gun Maverick was so massive for cinema. Mm-hmm. It was such an experience. This is such an experience.
Okay, will we black pudding it?
I want to tell you now, it is 2 hours and 49 minutes.
Yes, it's 170 minutes, it says, which is 2 hours and 50 minutes, which freaks me out a bit. So,
which, when I came out with one of my friends, well, I went with one friend only, but he said that it could be 20 minutes shorter.
Okay.
And I've said to him, I've seen movies that are an hour and a half that could be an hour shorter.
Mm,
so for a 2.5 hour movie,
3 hour nearly.
Yeah, like,
don't forget that.
It's phenomenal. I like it's get popcorn.
Black puddings, black
I'll
puddings.
Give it like, I'm gonna just give it 10.
Oh,
I had a great time.
That's your first 10 in a really long time. 10 black puddings.
Yeah, why not?
Out of 10 black puddings for Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. It's meant to be the last one. You think it is?
Probably will be, yeah.
Okay, good stuff.
I don't think he's able to do any more.
No, well, that is true. That was Brian Griffin. Thanks a million.
No problem.
The Sunday Grill with Orla Rappel on Beat 102-103.